Welcome to Discovery 2, Module 8. Before I continue, does anybody have any questions about Module 9, which was delivered last week, just to keep you all on your toes, regarding the troubleshooting process or any of the notes that we all theoretically should have read for Module 9 since the lecture last week? Anybody got any questions on that? Alrighty, we'll assume that as a no. Okay, Discovery 2 Module 8 concerns itself with ISP responsibility, and it talks about the various threats that exist when you are on the internet and those sorts of things, and what the ISP is supposed to do to mitigate those threats. Now, an ISP must have a security policy for equipment and business. And that is for their equipment and also for their business continuity plan. Obviously, an ISP is in the business of providing internet services. That's why they're called an internet service provider. And they tend to rely on their server infrastructure and their connectivity to the internet at large. If all of an ISP's servers go down, they have no business that they can use, and obviously control will silence that if it's talking, and obviously that's all right, I'm ignoring you. Unplug your speakers if you don't want it to make noise. Yeah, I plugged them in the back the other day. Okay. And we actually had an incident back in the mid-90s when I worked for a regional ISP where all of the servers were unstable. And luckily we were the only internet service provider in the town at the time. But because the market is so competitive, if you start having too many internet outages or servers falling over or whatever, you will lose customers. And I'm sure you can attest, Elise, if people's websites aren't up and running, they tend to be very unhappy with the hosting provider that is putting them up.
Oh, very definitely. They'll tell you, they will say, we're going to string you up if you don't get it fixed. And I had, I can give you plenty of real life experience on that, but definitely, yeah, people, particularly when it affects their business, and also some people use these services if they're demonstrating their product to a client. And certainly if they've got a mobile internet connection, if they're using that mobile internet connection when they're on a client's website, when they're on a client's site visiting a client, it's not a good look if they can't get on the internet or if they can't show off their website to their client or potential client. It tends to make businesses a little bit upset.
Yeah, it's interesting actually because I remember we were sitting at a. Somebody's looping back audio.
I think it's a buffer problem with having Windows running with Ventrilo. Interesting.
No, I think Grace might be set as green. Is she green?
I'm not even on.
You're not on?
No, it's.
You're not on?
I can't see Grace's light on.
1, 2, 3. Who's looping it back? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, looks like we're sorted now. Don't know what's going on there. Okay, so we're talking about viruses, which we should all know about. Malware, trojans, and worms can get onto people's computers. Alrighty. Now, obviously, if you have an unprotected PC and you have it connected to the internet, it can often be hit by threats. Now, we had an interesting story back in, I can't remember exactly when it was, I think it was 2003, 2004, somebody might be able to tell me, when the blaster worm came out. And I had a Telstra dial-up link, and I had 64 routable IP addresses.
2003.
Yes, it was 2003. And we were installing a copy of Windows XP onto a machine, and after about the second reboot, it was coming up with that the RPC service is not running error, and it kept crashing. And we actually thought it was the hardware. And it ended up being, it was being hit by the blaster worm. During the install, as soon as the networking was coming up, somebody was finding the IP address and hammering it with the blaster worm and taking the machine down. And we actually discovered that we could actually get through the install by disconnecting the internet cable until we'd finished, and then basically jamming in a flash drive with the fix patch on it, and then plugging it into the internet, and then it was all good. One of the other things they're saying in these notes is that often you get some threats from the inside and some threats from the outside. A lot of your threats actually come from infected customer PCs on your own network or on the ISP networks. And what we were actually finding at Lismore Internet was that most of the spyware and stuff was actually traversing from inside on the customer's PCs. They'd been infected previously, and it was being injected back into the corporate network, and it was actually attacking the machines in the office, and we actually had to put firewalls and stuff on the office PCs to stop them from being attacked. Now, obviously, if the ISP runs electronic funds transfer sites and stuff, people are very paranoid about financial security. If there is any chance that your financial information can be viewable from the outside or viewable by somebody else, or credit card numbers could be stolen or any of that sort of thing, people will not deal with your site and they will not trust e-commerce. And I think it was a couple of Christmases ago, they were actually seeing a drop-off of retail sales because people didn't have confidence in the online transaction market based on the fact that a few credit cards and stuff had been stolen, a few incidents of publicised credit card theft, credit card number theft, and that was actually undermining the entire industry. And I think everybody would agree that e-commerce in 2009 is huge. Okay, yeah, as the definitely. ISP... Sorry, go on, Les. Were you going to expand on that or just agree?
I was going to say, I'll definitely, as far as... I hope I'm still transmitting because my computer's gone all sluggish and I'll probably have to go for a reboot.
No, you
yes,
are.
You are. Yes,
no,
sir.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I was just agreeing with you, Kerry. E-commerce is huge, and any interactive website. So if people don't trust it, or any of the infrastructure between their computer and the website, they won't have a bar of it.
Absolutely. Well, that's the thing with a lot of the, sales over the internet. People are naturally a bit suspicious anyway.
You're getting that error dialogue? Kill the Realtek sound manager and that will go away in the task manager.
Not running Realtek.
Otherwise boot your wind.
I'm killing stuff in task manager left, right and centre, but
I'll fix that up after lecture.
I've already killed about...
Oh, sorry, Elise, I forgot to flip my mute switch.
Oh, sorry, no, I thought you were talking to me because I'm having problems at this end too. My apologies.
Do we want to wait... No, I'm not talking about you. Do you want to wait 20 seconds while you get your computer sorted out then? Has your machine sorted itself out, Elise, or is it still running sluggish?
I've just managed to kill Window Eyes. I think my computer is now running somewhat like a dual core must be doing. I don't know what caused all that, but I've also quit down, shut down 1,000 other applications that were here. So I shouldn't have to go for a reboot. And I shouldn't be lagging when it comes to miking up and stuff. Sorry about that, because I think that was probably coming from there.
No worries. These things happen.
Yep, it is. It's working perfectly now.
I'll chuck my USB sound card back. Okay, so if you're an ISP, you can help the clients to use secure passwords for devices. You can secure applications using patch management and software. Now, this is an interesting one. There are actually utilities, for example, Shavlik makes one that you can use free for 6 months or whatever, which is a security suite, and it will actually handle downloading all of your Windows updates and stuff. I know there's one for XP. I'm not sure whether one exists for Vista, but there is actually an application that will also download all of the Windows updates you need and let you burn them to a CD.
That's rather handy. Are you allowed to just stick them on your hard drive for installation later?
Yes, you can do that. It sticks them in a folder, but if you also burn that folder to CD, it will also allow you to insert that CD and apply all those patches.
Yep.
And I think it was the Windows Update Downloader or something. I have to Google for it, but I did actually find links to it from the Nlyte forums and stuff, because people actually use it when they're building the Zabel packs for Nlyte, which allow you to apply all of the updates to Windows Update for when you're doing your slipstream installs with your service packs and all of the update packs applied. Okay, the other thing you can do is you can remove unnecessary applications and services that cause security holes. Does anybody remember the Messenger service that starts up by default under the Windows Messenger service that starts up by default under Windows XP? And if you have it open and you are connected directly to the internet, you get all sorts of spam popping up in pop-up message boxes all over your system?
Yeah, I remember that in Windows 2000. It was before we got into routers and stuff, and we had a direct connection and was relying on zone alarm and all that as personal firewalls. And every now and again, you'd see one pop up. So what do? They use that service is there for administrators, isn't it? And they the spammers find it and tweak it and use it. Is that what happens?
Yeah, pretty much. There's a Windows messaging service, and it's supposed to allow you to send messages to other computers and stuff, and it's supposed to be used by various programs to alert you of things. But if the port is externally open to the internet and stuff... Because, interestingly enough, Windows 2000 does not ship with a firewall on it, a software firewall.
No, it does not. So, yeah, I don't think I've ever seen it under XP.
Well, it did used to happen, and sometimes people set up various firewall policies and stuff to get games and things working. They turn off the firewall, and the people that are most likely at risk is you get a lot of. It's less of a problem these days, but you used to get like a lot of internet plans where they'd sell you the single port dodgy modem. And that would provide no NAT or anything, so you'd have no firewall protection, and you'd basically have your publicly routable IP address directly on your system, and then people would wonder why they got hammered by a whole lot of internet threats, because their computer was directly on the internet. Made everything like torrents and Skype and stuff work a treat, but the increased risk was quite bad, and you could actually be quite a security threat, because you had your machine open to the internet.
Yes, I remember people getting on the net with those. We'll give you your free modem with your startup fee, and there you go, right on the net.
Did you just drop off, did you, Grace?
Yeah, Grace has dropped.
Yeah, no, that's okay. She's got the USB sound dongle because she's got a really bizarre hum in her MSI Win sound system, and we have no idea why.
Interesting.
Okie dokie. You should also make sure your applications and services are available to the users and no one else. That sounds pretty simple, but you'd be surprised how many people don't take those precautions. For example, if you have a website with a protected area that only needs to be accessed from a certain subnet, set it up so that the subnet will actually... can access that and nobody else can. Grace just had 3 MSN sign-in requests, which sounded a bit like she had like 3 M's on Wheel of Fortune.
Right.
Alrighty. Configure your desktop firewalls and your virus checking software. I don't know about anybody else, but a lot of the antivirus software these days is becoming quite difficult to configure, quite difficult to... Wow, that's loud. And trying to... You'll have to relaunch Quitter once you've got the USB card plugged in. Yeah, but you've got to relaunch Quitter. because it knows the default sound device is something else. So essentially, it's actually quite complex to configure this stuff, and most of the time you basically have to rely on the defaults that the manufacturer has set up in the hopes that that's going to be good for most of the users, and actually getting in and changing them is a bit complex, and often you have to be careful because some of the free versions or the light versions or the El Cheapo versions actually have a reduced feature set that don't allow you to set all of the user preferences that you'd like to be able to set, which is sometimes why it is worth paying for the more expensive version of the various programs. If it's free, there's probably a reason why it's free. You also can perform... Sorry, go on, Elise.
Yeah, a lot of people use those free or light versions of programs to give you the taste of the program and tell you that, yes, if you upgrade to the full expensive version, you do get all those nice features that we can show you we've got, but we won't let you use now.
I must say that I'm umming and ahhing as to whether I'm actually going to bother renewing my AVG license, because it is quite expensive. It's almost $100 Australian or whatever for a couple of years submission, and the free version does tend to do most of the things that I want it to.
Yeah, it gets a bit that way. You sort of wonder which way to go, don't you?
Yeah, mine comes up at the end of the year. I got an extra 6 months because I changed the engine last year, but I think it's due around about Christmas time.
Interesting.
I think they give you a two machine license for that $100, though, don't they?
No, I just got just one license.
No, I got a two. Well, yeah, they must have changed the way they sell them. I bought mine some time ago, and I got extended because of the change in from 7 to 8.
Yeah. Look, I'm not 100% sure how all that works, and often getting your way through all the licensing and figuring out what you actually need and what you actually need to buy and stuff is quite a maze as well.
Well, a good case in point is this one. The deal that you got, the deal that sort of Kerry got, is obviously somewhat different from the deal that I got. And we're looking like paying a similar amount of money on our renewal. So interesting. I think it just depends on when you bought yours and when I bought mine.
Although I have noticed that AVG Free has now started doing a lot more nagging than it used to. It does have a habit of popping up dialogues and things saying, you know, by the way, if you upgrade to the paid one, buy me. And the other interesting thing for blind people to be aware of is a lot of the discounts that AVG provide are on AVG Internet Security, which isn't particularly accessible, so you don't get the same discounts on the antivirus. Also, AVG, I don't want a spam filter. I'm not using POP. I don't want a spam filter. And by the way, I don't want a spam filter, and I also don't need a firewall. But thank you for trying to sell me one.
Yeah, and the firewalls are quite hard to actually configure. There's so many sort of settings on them.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Double negatives or something, you know. They sort of think, hang on, are they trying to tell me that they are blocking this or are allowing it? And I just gave up on one of mine one night and just went, yeah, allow, I'll be done with it, which isn't the right thing to do. But, you know, I was fed up with being prompted for messages and being blocked from this and blocked from that. I just had to be on the net.
Yeah, well, this is it, and this is the complexity of software firewalls and things that can certainly cause you some grief. And I mean, there's two sides to the actual story. One of them is, do we want to see if you can mic up? No. No, I can hear her.
Oh, she's there, really quiet.
Noise. Yeah,
she's really
microphone
she's
level
really
on that
quiet.
Card. It's all right. Grace is having those. I'll just stick antivirus on before I set up Ventrilo days, and of course Ventrilo has decided to break, which would have been the antivirus if she'd done them in the other order. Okay, so you're disabling the services you don't need, and you are configuring the ones that you do have for the least impact and stuff. Now, this is an interesting one, because a lot of people configure services up and they just put them in the default configurations, and they don't bother locking them down to the actual machines and IPs and things that actually need to access them. They just leave them open to the world at large. And they, for example, rely on hidden URLs that nobody will ever find. You'd be actually surprised at how many websites you can actually go to www.sitename.com/images, and they haven't bothered to turn off indexing in their images folder, so you can either refat all their images or grab a whole lot of other stuff that's hiding in the images folder. And there's actually an interesting site that you can look at which teaches you about some of these cross-scripting site attacks and some of these other site attacks called www.hackthissite.com. And it actually does workshops in cross-scripting and how to hack into various websites and things you should check for on your own website.
Yeah, that's definitely handy to know about. And I'm not saying that because I want to go off and hack a whole ton of websites. It's that I want to find out how these buggers are hacking my websites. We've gone and changed a whole heap of passwords, but it is a problem. You put up a website and Mr. Shall Not Be Named from Country Shall Not Be Named and probably State Sponsored Shall Not Be Named comes along and hacks it and puts a virus on there. It redirects you off to another website, installs an ActiveX control and turns your Windows box into a nice little zombie.
Exactly, and there are hundreds of thousands of computers that are zombied and available in botnets that go out and attack things like Facebook and Twitter and all those sorts of things. And it brings up an interesting ethical question, or an interesting logistic question. Could you imagine what sort of havoc it would cause if something really nasty got onto, say, the front page of Facebook?
Whoa, nasty.
No, we can't hear you. Grace just said, half the internet would be down.
Pretty much. You'd turn all those little kiddies' Windows boxes into nice big fat Trojans very quickly, probably.
But it would affect a lot of people. It would affect executives, it would affect business people, it would affect, you know, housewives, it would affect, I mean, you know, who isn't on Facebook?
Well, exactly.
Except for Geraldine, she's about the only one who isn't on Facebook. It'll just be everybody else but Geraldine on Facebook pretty soon. But yeah, essentially, it's an incredible wide-reaching problem. And there's all sorts of stuff you can go into on techno-warfare and all those sorts of things. It's becoming quite lucrative. There are a whole lot of Russian mafia gangs involved in it because it's more more profitable than the regular stuff of actually going and bashing people up.
Yeah, it's easier to bash up a whole lot of websites and install a whole lot of Trojans, and the next thing you've got a million computers infected for next to nothing.
Still can't hear you.
Still can't hear you, Gracie.
You want me to take a 5-second look? Yeah, hang on, at least I'll have a quick look.
Should this thing still be recording? I often say to people that it's not just the kids who have got nothing to do of a weeknight when they should be doing their homework that's using Facebook and Twitter and other social media. It is executives. It is now getting to the point where social networking is making a heck of a long route into business, particularly small and micro business. And you would really do a lot of damage to somebody if you wrecked Facebook or Twitter these days.
Yeah, that's true. Something I've avoided to this stage.
Oh, look, I'm the same. I 6 months ago, they come to me and said, oh, you have to get in. Well, people did come to me and went, you've got to get into social networking. I went, well, a lot of rubbish. That's just garbage that teenagers do when they've got nothing to do. But no, I've seen the benefit of it for our business.
There is. It's just something I've avoided and intend to stay that way.
That's fair enough. And while we're on it, we might as well plug www.twitter.com/CiscoVision, which is our own Cavi Twitter feed. So the announcements are going up on there, left, right and centre, which is all good. But, of course, there's still the email lists, which is where most of the announcements still are. And we'll continue to say
that's
so.
Right.
Oh, a nice little buzzy noise. No audio, though. How not to set up your Ventrilo. Something to hand over the audio system on that wind, I think.
No.
Is it running Vista or XP?
Vista.
Oh, well, there's your answer. I've seen it happen where the whole audio subsystem gets wrecked.
Sorry, I stand corrected. This one's XP.
Oh, it's XP, is it? No, I'll end on. I won't launch into a diatribe of what happens to the audio subsystem on Vista, regardless of whatever sound card you have plugged into it.
Alrighty. I should be back now.
You are.
You are.
Okay, good. Right. We'll resolve the audio problems on both machines later. There is a strength and a weakness to Skype and Ventrilo. Ventrilo will not tamper with any of your audio settings, which means you are responsible for getting them all right yourself. And Skype will tamper with all of your audio settings, whether or not it's even using that card or not.
Yes.
And it'll reset your recording levels. And in fact, I know somebody who was trying to record a football match and made the mistake of launching Skype. And it reset her record source for her.
Yep, and I seen it happen on my older computer, Firebolt, when I had, I think I had Skype talking to the Realtek, and went in and configured it all up manually, and I was watching the audio mixer, and I had that looking at the Sound Blaster, and I saw the microphone level go down on the... actual fact, no, I saw the master volume go down on the other on the Sound Blaster, the card that Skype wasn't supposed to be using. It said, well, we are just going to turn your audio right down on all channels on the alternative card, and that's that.
I actually noticed another quirk. If you have, and I've actually, this is probably worth mentioning in case anybody's running it, if you have Total Recorder installed and you have its drivers installed, which is a reasonable thing to do, and you have Skype set to use a USB sound card rather than your regular sound card, and you pull the USB sound card back, often the sound will drop back to the Total Recorder device, which is fine. Everything will work until you actually receive a Skype call, and then if you alt page up to answer the Skype call, it will end up muting your audio for you, so you lose all audio, and then you've got to go back into the mixer. Yeah. But it's actually a problem. It's an interaction between Skype and the Total Recorder driver. So, stuff.
It certainly really gets upset, although I can't help blaming Skype for being upset if you rip its sound card away from it like that, but it really shouldn't be messing around with the settings on another sound device.
Well, the other problem is, of course, that it doesn't actually... There's no default as to what you're going to fall back to. There's no way to set the fallback order, so you fall back onto the Total Recorder rather than your actual internal sound card.
Actually, there is.
Yeah.
In Skype 4.1, you can decide what order it's going to do things in, assuming that the devices are present, and assuming that it knows what devices are present, and assuming it's actually au fait with what devices are present and which ones are not. The problem is actually both with Windows and Skype, because when you actually unplug, when you actually remove the USB sound card, it's up to Windows where it falls back to.
That's right.
And then, of course, Skype will go and smash your settings on something else just because it feels like it. So it's not, it's sort of both people's fault. It's not totally Skype's fault. And yes, you can lock Skype onto various devices in 4.1, and provided those devices exist, Skype will be very happy, but there are actually underlying problems with the Windows infrastructure that cause that to fail quite spectacularly. Anyway, back onto lecture topic. Keep your operating system patched. We've already had discussions about people who are too scared to run Windows Update, or refuse to run Windows Update, or don't want to run Windows Update because of genuine advantage, because the copy of Windows they got was from their mate. We do not condone that sort of behaviour. And they just think that if they don't run Windows Update forever, they'll be fine. But they are usually likely to be hit by the latest email worm or whatever, and they'll lose lots of data and be very unhappy about it. Try keep normal user rights rather than admin ones. Well, dream about it. how many programs will not run unless you are an admin user? Microsoft would like to think you could run programs as a regular user, and in fact you can't. And then, of course, the same thing happens under Vista, where you have to right-click on a whole stack of programs and go run as administrator, because we just don't want to behave ourselves unless we are running with administrative privileges. So I'm glad the word try is in there. Look at security scanning tools such as Nessus, LSIS, Port Sentry. There are various other security tools. The MBSA, or the Microsoft Baseline Security Analyzer, MBSA even, is quite a useful tool for scanning for basic security flaws on your machine. And it's free. People like that. Nessus is pretty cool if you can get it running, and there are versions for Windows and Linux. ISPs should encrypt data stored on ISP hard drives. I don't think they usually do, because if they lose the password or somebody loses the password, they're going to have nobody's data, but theoretically they should. They should use permissions to secure access to files and folders. That makes sense. Permit access based on the user account, depending on their group, so don't give users access to stuff they shouldn't have access to. Assign different levels of access permission based on the user and group membership. Okay, we have to discuss AAA, which is not your credit rating. It's authorization. What is it? Oh, authentication, authorizing, and accounting. And it refers to the ability of the servers with the ISP and stuff to be able to validate your login and to log your login and account your usage and all of that sort of stuff. A couple of systems that do that. There is TACAX, which is the Cisco proprietary one, or there is RADIUS, Remote Authentication Dial-In User Service, and it will allow you to authenticate users and stuff like that. Now, a lot of you would ask, why is this even relevant? Every time you dial onto your ADSL account, generally speaking, you have to use PPPoE. In Australia, generally, you can actually get other connection types, but they're phasing them out. And you, whenever you log on, you actually authenticate with Telstra's or whoever your ADSL provider's RADIUS server. And then that RADIUS server actually hands the credentials onto the ISP, and then the ISP is responsible for doing the billing on connected time or account volume, etc.
Whose RADIUS server do you use if you're using ADSL2 infrastructure in Australia?
I would say you'd be using Telstra's, and then the credentials are handed onto your ISP.
Okay, but even with ADSL2 Plus?
No, you said ADSL2, you didn't say Plus.
ISPs. Yeah, that's what I thought. Sorry, yep.
And sadly, in that particular instance, the difference between the 2 and the 2 Plus is crucial. Theoretically, the 2 Plus DSLAMs are run by the ISPs themselves, and they actually put them in the exchange, and it's their infrastructure that you are reliant on.
Yep. That's why it usually takes two authentication attempts with my current ISP to get a log on.
Yes.
And I think we're announcing it.
Yes.
Might have sent a few mood messages over the week. And
We certainly have, and we had a chuckle at those. and for litigation reasons, we will keep the ISP name off lecture.
Correct. Exactly.
Yes, so that's all good. We're talking about data encryption, so we get to talk about SSL, which is Secure Sockets Layer, and TLS, which is Transport Layer Security, which is a way of securing protocols that don't natively have security in them, such as Telnet and FTP. SSL is Big Bickies. Basically, it works with a set of private and public keys. You are looking at the private keys, which are held by the individuals, and the public keys, which are then given out so that you can authenticate one with the other. So you can authenticate a private key with a public key, and you can authenticate a public key with a private key. So if you encrypt something with somebody's public key, they decrypt it with their private key. If they sign it with their private key, you can verify it with their public key. Basically, they are two very big prime numbers, and you multiply them together to get the key, and that is how the public key cryptography system works. In a nutshell, they're two very long 1024-bit prime numbers, and the product of those numbers becomes the encryption key to your message. You have secure protocols such as SSH, SSL, all those sorts of good things. Skype is theoretically secure, except unless you get that Trojan on your system that hijacks all of your voice over IP calls. And then there is insecure protocols such as Telnet, regular FTP, and regular HTTP. Users can sniff packets off the wire at various points to be able to grab a whole lot of passwords for protocols such as POP, FTP, Telnet, etc. IPsec can globally secure everything, but it's a real pain to set up, and there's quite a lot of configuration required. You've got the AA, which is the authentication header, and then you've got ESP, which is the encapsulation security payload. And I looked at it one morning, and I did get it working, but it was certainly a mind bend. Denial of services attacks. That would be an example of a real-world denial-of-service attack would be if Grace was trying to set up her audio and I stood behind her and kept going, is it working yet? How's it going? Is it working? Like, have you set that up? Like, what are you doing? It would be really annoying and she wouldn't be able to get any useful work done. That would be a denial-of-service attack in the real world. A denial-of-service attack on computers is where you ping flood, nuke, smurf, any of those sorts of attacks, and you can look those up on Wikipedia. You can put those on MSN rather than on the actual main chat, because everybody sees those ones. Or I could go and tip a cold bucket of water over. That would be another denial of service attack. Just an example. So distributed denial of services is where you have lots of machines, as we talked about the botnets, attacking a particular site or group of sites. Lots of sites have come under attack in the last number of years. Recently, Facebook and Twitter have been down. Facebook and Twitter, also MSN.com, eBay.com, and WhiteHouse.gov gets wiped out every now and again. All sorts of ones that get attacks launched on them. Distributed denial of service attack is where you can trick computers to respond to packets that are not from the computer that sent the packets, and they are harder to trace. You can do port filtering, so you can actually limit connections based on what port they're coming in on, whether they're coming in on port 80, 21, 23, all that sort of good stuff. You can limit your connections based on that, both incoming and outgoing, or UDP ports. Now, interestingly enough, OpenDNS provides protection from a lot of these sites. I don't know whether anybody's using OpenDNS here. I know Jackie's a great proponent of it. But you can set up anti-phishing protection. You can also do things like block Facebook and YouTube, which is a great boost for productivity. Also, a lot of workplaces block Twitter because they don't feel that people should be tweeting during work hours. You can certainly burn a lot of time on Twitter. We don't block it here, but there are a lot of workplaces. For example, one of my friends in Melbourne who works for the ANZ cannot tweet from work. It also becomes an issue of leakage of potentially proprietary information if you can tweet from work, and some people say that you shouldn't be able to do that. And no, they're not allowed to email stuff out either. And they can only access their appropriate internal websites. And they can't plug any thumb drives in either. Yes, Twitter can be an excellent resource, provided that the tweets are actually relevant and on work topic. What would happen, for example, if you tweeted and said, "My boss is a complete drongo," and put his name in the tweet? There have been instances where that's happened. In fact, there was an interesting case where somebody rang up work and said they were having a sickie, and then posted on their Facebook status, "Sitting at home, kicking back, enjoying a few beers. Gotta love sick days." Problem was, this person had forgotten that their boss was on their Facebook account and saw the update to the status message. Said employee got fired. Pretty much. We just had a comment from a local person here saying not a particularly clever student. They put it in perhaps more succinctly. So, yeah, all good. Now, stateful packet inspection firewalls. Can anybody tell me what a stateful packet inspection firewall is? What's a stateful packet inspection? I'll just relay you.
It is a...
And you didn't activate my microphone. So that is a system where a firewall checks to see whether packets are actually requested to get through. Now, in more succinct terms, what a stateful packet inspection firewall actually does is it actually looks at the states of the TCP and UDP connections that are open at any given time, which is why it's called stateful. It then inspects packets that come in and go out and makes sure that those packets belong to the specific connections that are already open through the firewall in either direction. So that's why it's called stateful, because it looks at the states of the connections. Packets, because it looks inside the packets at the ports that the packets are destined from and to. And inspection, because it's actually looking. So there's your stateful inspection packet firewall. This means that if you initiate a connection outbound from the firewall to a remote host, it will allow packets to go out from the internal host and return on that particular connection, but it will not allow packets from other hosts destined to the same ports that are already open inside the network. In internal IDS, anybody got any questions on any of that before we continue? Yep, the only reason we go over that is because you get lots of routers that provide that basically have blurb on the box that says provides stateful inspection firewall, SPI. I always wondered why they had to put stateful inspection firewall and then SPI as if it told me something more. It's like, well, thank you, you've now told me what the abbreviation is, but that gives me no idea what stateful inspection does at all, and neither does your book. Also has a natural firewall, DDoS protection, port logging, intrusion monitoring, ping blocking, smurf, ping off death, etc. Now, if you knew what all those things were, it would enhance your idea of security. But if you have no idea what a ping of death is, you can go look up Wikipedia, but the average user probably doesn't know what smurf or land or ping of death or any of those things are. Often you find that the firewalls that are on the routers are not easy to configure, and what a lot of users do is they don't put any rules to accept traffic into their firewall and then enable it and then wonder why their internet stops working because their default policy was set to deny. Okay, now an intrusion detection system is a system that looks for traffic and sends alerts to various workstations and things to make sure that the traffic is rejected. Is logged so that it can see that they're actually coming in. An intrusion prevention system is one that actually sits in the middle and actually prevents the intrusions from actually hitting the network at all by actually blocking them. In intrusion detection systems, some of them can actually watch for intrusions and actually reconfigure various network devices if they see intrusions. Actually, I don't know whether you're running it on your Linux servers. Have you ever heard of a thing, Elise, called fail to ban? Okay, we'll rephrase that question later. Okay, we're discussing wireless security, as ISPs can have hotspots. Make sure your wireless hotspots are secure. Make sure they have the necessary encryptions turned on and the necessary authentication requirements, etc. It used to be actually quite popular for some ISPs. They actually have a couple of computers in the building or a wireless hotspot where the public can come in and use computers, and that will actually allow you to let backpackers and people who don't have regular net access use the internet. Also, a lot of public libraries have hotspots, and they also allow the public to access the internet, so they need all sorts of security measures and stuff in place so that they don't get their machines compromised. Okay, so the notes mention encryption, such as WPA, WPA, PSK, WEP, etc., MAC address filtering, and authenticating the workstations. Hidden SSID, don't have your wireless networks broadcasting their SSID, it makes them slightly more difficult to protect, slightly more difficult to detect, I should say, and you actually need two wireless stations communicating and a copy of Kismet or a similar wireless sniffing tool such as NetStumbler and the right wireless drivers to actually pick up hidden SSIDs. EAP is two-way authentication. The client authenticates the server. The server authenticates the client. There's a thing called extensible authentication protocol. Cisco has one called LEAP, which is lightweight extensible authentication protocol. WEP uses 64, 128, or 256-bit hex keys to encrypt traffic. WPA uses temporal key integrity protocol, which changes keys on a regular basis. WPA2 can use AES, which is one of the federal encryption standards over in the US, which, if you're the paranoid person who believes in conspiracy theory, means that the government's already cracked it. I don't know whether that's true or not, but a lot of people think that because if it's government ratified, they must have found a way of busting into it. And sadly, the US government has been known for selling Enigma cipher machines to third world countries with the complete knowledge that the Enigma cipher had already been broken, which would then render all of the third world countries' cryptographic communications open to the government. Isn't that wonderful?
Probably true.
And they also did the same with DES. They just kept selling the DES gear to the third world countries, even though they had the ability to actually crack the DES cipher in a small amount of time. Okay, host-based firewalls. They can detect known attacks based on signatures. They are ones that run on a particular computer. Unknown attacks can be limited by blocking unknown traffic. Makes a bit of sense. If you don't know what it is, don't let it in. It's important to have incident logging and the necessary infrastructure to deal with security incursions, such as documentation, procedures, what you're going to tell the public, what you're not going to tell the public, and all of that sort of thing, because people need to know how to behave and what procedures to follow when they are under stress. Service level agreements, we've talked about those. That's what sort of services you're providing to your client, what your minimum turnaround times for repairs are, what your minimum turnaround times are for getting in contact with a technician. All of those sorts of services that rely on business integrity. And businesses get very cranky when their integrity is interrupted, because every disruption of integrity is a loss of money for those businesses. You should have the description of the service in your SLA so that you know exactly what you're providing to the customer, the cost of the service and the cost of the SLA, and any extra costs that may be incurred. Tracking and reporting as to what you're going to do to make sure that your side of it is documented in such a way that your customer will be able to look at that. Your problem management, what are you going to do if a problem does come up for the person who does have the SLA? Security, in other words, yeah? Sorry, was somebody going to say something, or was that just a... termination, under what conditions can you or the client terminate the service level agreement? The penalties for service outages, what's going to happen to you if there are service outages, and all those sorts of things. The availability of the service, what availability percentage you're trying to get, what performance benchmarks you're going to have, and the reliability of the service, what sort of expectation of failure and stuff do you have, and how are you going to uphold that. ISPs must monitor their links to detect problems so that they will know what's going up and what's going down. Now, I was going to ask you, Elise, are you running fail to ban on any of your Linux servers?
No. I don't even know what it is.
This is one that the Craigery and the Big W and stuff should take a look at, and there probably are Red Hat packages for it. It's basically a script that watches your authentication logs, and if you see more than a certain number of rejected SSH attempts in a certain time frame, it'll actually block access to SSH from that host for an hour, or a configurable delay.
From that host or from any host? That would be rather cool, actually. So, yeah, that would be cool.
From whatever, from the host that's actually trying to get in touch with you.
Yeah, no, that would be good. Might look into that. There's probably an RPM for that. A lot of people are starting to use those things any more than a certain amount of failed authentication attempts. It locks out the account for however long.
Yeah, exactly. And it's probably quite a good idea as far as security is concerned to do that. And obviously, it's an added layer of protection. I think it's called fail, and the number 2, and the word ban. So it's not very difficult to get going. It basically uses IP tables and stuff. But it's quite a nifty defense. And it stops people from brute forcing passwords and stuff on your server, especially if they get locked out after a certain number of invalid attempts.
Might just Google that up in a tick.
The notes also tell us to talk about in-band management and out-of-band management. We did talk about that previously. Out-of-band management is where you use a console port or a port that does not carry network traffic to manage a device, and out-of-band allows you to do things like password resets and all those sorts of good things. In-band management is where you manage it over the network and you measure it over the network with the same traffic along with the regular traffic to the server. The notes are saying use SSH instead of Telnet where possible for a couple of reasons. One is because it's encrypted, and there are also options to turn on compression with SSH, and that can make a difference as far as latency is concerned, especially over low bandwidth links. But even over high bandwidth links, it can actually cause you to transfer less data because you have the compression turned on, and that can actually result in some quite measurable speed-ups. Make sure the software supports either SSH1 or SSH2, depending on which one you're using, and make sure it's properly licensed. Okay. Any questions on that before we continue?
Okay, at this point.
Alrighty. SNMP is Simple Network Management Protocol, which is anything but simple. And it allows you to query devices for statuses and packet counts and all those sorts of things, and then the software can collate that information and create meaningful reports and status reports and things. There is another interesting package which I saw called JFF NMS, which stands for Just For Fun Network Management System, and it's a free network management system that will tell you what's up and what's down, what's hot and what's not. Bit of a trick to set up, but once you get it running, it's certainly not just for fun. There's also a thing called syslog on Unix systems, which logs all sorts of system messages. It also logs them on OS X and other sorts of systems. That allows you to look at those messages and find out what's going on the system. Also useful for checking on things such as after an attack and all those sorts of good things. It wants us to talk about backups and backup media, so we'll do very quickly, we'll cover that. You've got three types of backups. You've got full backups, which means you back up everything. Differential is where you take a full backup and then you back up everything that has changed since the last full backup, which means to restore all your data, you restore your full backup and your latest differential. An incremental backup is where you back up everything that has changed since the last backup. So if you back up with a full backup and then do an incremental, you get everything that's changed since the last full backup. If you do another incremental, you'll get everything that changes since the first incremental was run. So to restore your data, you restore the full backup and all of the incremental backups in order since the backup that you originally took. which was a full one, and they have various ways of doing that. So you basically do, say, a full backup on Monday, and the rest of the time you do incrementals and that sort of thing, depending on the size of your tape library and all those sorts of things. Obviously, those terms are important if you're doing ITE1, and it helps to know those as much as possible. The other thing you've got to do is you've got to protect against hardware and software failure. So have redundant components, have redundant software if possible, have uninterruptible power supplies, multiple network links, all of that sort of good redundant stuff that is worth having as much as possible. Also note that things are often broken by user error. They are also broken by malicious activity, and also talk about data theft, which is where all of your trade secrets and stuff get stolen by people who shouldn't. Operating system failure can result in data loss, and it's interesting to note that most operating systems that I've ever seen have a little disclaimer in their terms and conditions that nobody ever reads that says, "This operating system is not to be used on life support systems or in life-threatening situations such as emergencies."
Yes, having a heart-lung machine having a blue screen of death would be a problem.
It certainly would, because then you'd have a blue patient.
Yeah.
Okay, also be aware that when you're choosing your media for your backup and your media for your storage, you've got to look at the factors of the amount of data, the cost of the backup media, the performance of the media, how long does it take to back things up, the reliability of the media, there's nothing worse than having your tapes fail, so make sure you test your backups, and the ease of off-site storage. The notes basically refer here to direct access storage, which is storage that is directly connected to your system, network attached storage, which is where you have storage available over the network, and a network attached, and then a storage area network is where you actually have a special network that is specifically dedicated to storage. You basically have to make sure that your backup solution is working. Media needs to be swapped and logs need to be looked through. And make sure you perform trial restores. There's nothing worse than having a whole safe full of backup tapes until you find out that none of it can actually be restored and all of your backups weren't any good anyway. Disaster recovery plans. What are you going to do if the server does go down? Do you have a backup server? How long is it going to take you to get things back online? In what order are you going to bring things back online? How long is it going to take? And what are you going to tell people while it's all coming back online? Make sure you know all of this disaster recovery stuff before disaster strikes. There's nothing that's much less fun than actually working all of this out when everything's crashed and everything's shut down. Any questions on any of that? Because if there isn't, any questions on last week's module? Otherwise, here endeth the lecture.
Oh, last one was troubleshooting, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Module 9 was troubleshooting, and it was a troubleshooting process, and I was talking about using the layers of the OSI reference model either to work up or down or do the divide and conquer thing for troubleshooting.
Well, I think I, for one, am pretty happy with all that. I don't think I have any questions at the moment.
Yep, and Grace is pretty happy with that as well, so that's all good. Alright. I'm just going to stop recording.